The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I think this is where you see the special place that gold and silver play in a portfolio. It's underappreciated today, that element of non-counterparty exposure. It was a core emphasis in 2008 and 2009. I think that's going to be a core emphasis at some point in the future. In the months and years ahead, people will demand physical delivery at any price.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, there's a lot of confusion right now. We've got this Trans-Pacific Agreement that is being talked about. Nobody really understands what it says, but we have an avowed, self-proclaimed socialist, Bernie Sanders, saying that it's a disaster. We've got Trump coming out from the other side saying it's a disaster. You've got Hillary, who 45 times she voted for it or worked towards it when she was Secretary of State, and now she's distancing herself from it. Yet you've got Obama who's supporting it. What does it mean, Dave?
Yeah, what is it exactly? It's 12 participating countries, which represent 40% of the world's trade, in theory, right. And they're creating a trade bloc, which, again, in theory, should reduce trade barriers and increase the flow of goods. That is what it is on the surface. And that's really all we have, is what it is on the surface. And I may be naive on this, but I was under the assumption that global trade wasn't really that restrictive at this point in history anyways.
So do you think they created a problem to solve because they have things that they want to do differently or controlling-wise?
New Zealand's a big winner. They're an ag producer, and yes, there are tariffs that are going to be reduced as they export their goods. So there are some winners and some losers in the mix. But I think the interesting point is that a trade deal with a focus on the Pacific, or shall I say Asia, that doesn't include China. Keep that in mind.
That smells strange, doesn't it? China, the largest economic force in Asia and actually the world.
To me, that makes this whole agreement sort of three parts geopolitical for every one part economic. So It may fly under the radar of a trade agreement, but I think there's actually some geopolitical posturing going on in the region.
Wasn't it strange that the premier was in the United States just 10 days before they came up with this agreement?
I think it's also worthy of note that the agreement was made within 10 days of the Chinese premier's visit to the U.S., and this has been a five-year process, The agreement being hammered out, and it was supposed to be completed 3 years ago. And so it's been lingering, and they can't quite get it agreed to. And then all of a sudden, the first visit from the premier, and it's done. And China's on the outside looking in.
Well, you know what it reminds me of, Dave? Remember the old days when everyone was arguing about NAFTA? What was NAFTA to do for the worker here in the United States, or what was it to do for the corporation? Seems like you've got those same arguments with this as well.
Well, that's right. The opponents, the primary opponents to this, look at it as sort of NAFTA on steroids, Which it may be. What we do know about it is that it's relating to trade in some obscure way. But it is a little bit like Obamacare. To understand it, we have to pass it first, And then we get to read the documents after the fact. And that's perhaps the concerning point to me. Not concerning, I suppose, if you have implicit trust in your political leadership, but concerning if you don't. The TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is simply not transparent. So We now have the biggest trade deal since 1994, the Uruguay round and the creation of the World Trade Organization. And in the coming months, there will be more released on it as each side gets to ratify the deal that was just signed in Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, one of the things that people have brought up as a concern is privacy, the control of data, you know, because you're going to have free exchange, apparently, not just of trade and goods, but also information about people.
Exactly. You've got a whole host of things that, again, on a blind basis, we're being asked to say yes to. That is strict rules for the environment, new labor laws, standards for investment, control of data, both its flow and storage. These are issues that, again, are being agreed to on sort of a transnational basis and outside of your normal legislative processes. Fortunately, everything gets to be ratified by Congress and various legislative bodies around the world. But I think this is where it may actually come to nothing. The TPP, like the Transatlantic Partnership, it's taken a long time to go virtually nowhere. And the Transatlantic Partnership is the same kind of agreement in principle with the United States and Europe.
Let me ask you, Dave, does this have anything to do with what you talked about 3 weeks ago after you got back from Asia. You said that China's going to put trillions of dollars towards opening up the markets between China, Europe, the Middle East, you know, a free flow of goods. Do you think this is our response by excluding China to try to build up some sort of defense against that?
It's what Peter Chow described as globalization 4.0, the next round of globalization driven by the reestablishment of the Silk Road in China, creating not only an energy, but a transportation pipeline to all of Europe from Asia. And I think it could very well be, and maybe that's the smartest part of this, is us creating some sort of a block against Chinese growth. And I suspect that that counterweight is perhaps what gives it some merit. But I think notable is the tighter relations that it creates between the U.S. and Japan. Mm. And you could even consider it something of a strategic alliance. It's been suggested that the U.S. and Japan will see much greater integration in terms of a supply chain. And when you think about that, you know who's going to oppose it, and you probably better appreciate why Bernie Sanders and others who are more associated with labor would be concerned. Because if we integrate our supply chains more with the Japanese, what does that mean for car parts manufacturers and car manufacturers here in the United States? Labor here would have to look at the TPP and be very upset.
Do you remember when we interviewed Friedman about a month ago, and Dr. Friedman said that Japan is where we should be looking, not China, as far as a rise in trade?
I thought about that when I was looking through the details of the TPP, and I thought about Friedman's comments, and I think you're right. It is a way that we get to, as a collective, instead of just us doing a bilateral trade agreement with the Japanese, it allows us and, you know, 10 other people to be in partnership with the Japanese and reinforce their importance. So you've got two of the top three economies in the world, if you take China out of that top three, who are in principle agreeing to closer economic ties and relationships. That's very, very significant. And I think what Friedman was suggesting was essentially the next decade or two is not the decade of the Chinese, it's the decade of the Japanese. That's going to be hard to swallow for many market operators who look at the current situation in the Japanese markets and consider it very frail. Mm-hmm. And I'm not exactly sure how to address those concerns. But I do think our partnership with the Japanese underscores some support for them, geopolitically, at least.
Well, you know, there's something else that affects the rest of the world outside of the United States, and that, of course, is currency manipulation. We've seen the emerging markets literally falling apart because the U.S. dollar is so strong relative to their currencies. And you've brought out in the past that any of those countries that have borrowed in dollars have to pay it back in dollars. Now, is there a limitation on currency manipulation in this agreement?
No, there really isn't. It's not addressed explicitly. And maybe that's because two of the biggest participants in the group are two of your biggest offenders, so to say, in terms of currency manipulation. Our quantitative easing, that program was death to the dollar on a short-term basis. And if you look at the Abenomics, the approach that Abe's cabinet has taken to managing their economy over the last several years, it's put a lot of pressure on the yen. Mm-hmm. And so we are two of the great offenders in terms of currency manipulation.
Well, watching the news over the last couple of days, it was amazing to see how violent the French can be when they're not running away from the enemy. They're running after their bosses. Talk about labor relations. You know, labor is always who's upset about the NAFTAs and the trade agreements. They're always looking at, will this displace my job? Rightfully so. And what we saw in France, of course, these guys literally undressing their bosses as they beat them up, the executives of the corporation. Where does labor factor in on this?
You know, I think one of the funny things is there is an undercurrent of Marxism in the TPP agreement. Hmm. And it is this strong support for labor. That's not to say that there's not a good reason for fair wages and things of this nature. But I think we're in a context where we're going to see a shift away from emphasis and reward to capital and more of an emphasis and reward to labor over the next 3 to 5 to 10 years.
Which is clearly out of Marx. You know, if there's going to be profit, it needs to go to labor and not to the capital.
That's how Marx saw profit. He didn't see it as a return on invested capital. He saw it as excess, and that excess was exploitative to labor. And in fact, could only be explained in terms of what should have, by rights, gone to labor and was instead squeezed from them and given to capital instead. And so it seems to me that the days of labor arbitrage are ending. And to the degree that we see an increase in the cost of labor, which is one of the things that the TPP is calling for, which is sort of, you know, imagine a base wage in Vietnam, a base wage in Malaysia, a minimum wage, if you will. Mm-hmm. As soon as you start marking up the cost of goods, consider what that does throughout the world. Number one, it makes them less competitive in terms of the goods that they manufacture, unless, of course, they're willing to pass through those higher costs to the United States and Europe, in which case we see the equivalent of price inflation. Mm-hmm. The Walmart effect, essentially, if you want to consider the last 20 to 30 years of consumption spending in the United States having been subsidized by Walmart's trade agreements and manufacturing benefits, where they've been buying the cheapest products from the cheapest suppliers anywhere in the world, that Walmart subsidy is about to go away. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a change in the equation where labor the world over does see some benefit, but capital is going to have to ask the question, how do we invest in the context where we're being disadvantaged or returns are being diminished?
So whenever we hear the word free trade or globalism, the way I think of prices coming down worldwide. But in this case, it's like Obama healthcare. Sometimes you have to say, well, is it really healthcare or is it something the opposite of that? And free trade, they're calling this free trade, but actually maybe it's not. Maybe it's restricted trade and the money's going to be apportioned elsewhere. I think that's what you're saying.
We've said this before in a different context, but you know, the powers that be like to choose winners and losers.
Right.
And we've seen the central banks do that in terms of who gets what at the free money trough. And this is really, again, a question of who gets what. I think in that sense, there is a strong political overtone, undertone, I don't know how you'd want to describe it, where essentially you're determining who is going to get what over the next 3 to 5 to 10 years. And if Wall Street and corporations get a little bit less and labor gets a little bit more, I mean, I'll be honest, maybe that is fair, quote unquote, but it is going to force a decision amongst the allocators of capital and it's going to change the marketplace pretty radically. So I think there may be some unintended consequences from this that, again, it's intended to increase global trade, but it may actually create some real consternation because you're disadvantaging capital.
Well, and we've seen with the control of the marketplace over the last 5 or 6 years with the central bankers, the feeling that there are people who are in control and capital and labor will just flow wherever they choose. But it's turning out that volatility is scaring away people who would normally lean on that control. I'm thinking of hedge fund managers. Just this week, you were talking to a hedge fund manager who says, you know what? We're going to play wait and see for a little while. We're going to go to cash and gold. We're not going to play right now because volatility is making them think that maybe they don't want to be there to catch the falling knife.
There's a growing audience, whether it's Ray Dalio at Bridgewater or Stanley Druckenmiller. I mean, there's many who are saying to themselves, something doesn't look or feel quite right.
Right.
Mohammed Al-Arian wrote in this week's Financial Times arguing that the increase in volatility may keep institutions much more tentative, and that they normally play a role, that of market stabilizer, as they come in and allocate assets and create sort of a countercyclical cushion when stock prices begin to drop. And he's suggesting that that role is likely to be abdicated. Hmm. And what's the basis for that? It's that there is this structural shift in volatility, and it's causing institutions to reconsider what they want to allocate towards a risk exposure. And he discusses the quote-unquote prolonged period of volatility suppression created by the Fed and the ECB, and how they would rather not give that up. So we've had volatility suppression for years. And again, I mean, think about that. He knows it. We know it. We've talked about it before. The activity of the world's central banks has been to create a sense of calm. It's been a vast PR gambit,
right,
to bring about amongst the minds of the average investor, all is well, it's okay, put your money to work, go spend like a good soldier. And the reality is they can't undo what they've been doing without a grave consequence. So what are they going to do? You've got this prolonged period of volatility suppression. Now you've got volatility peaking up. And what is the cause of that? Really, it's an anticipation of an increase in rates.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask the question, what would change their attitude towards risk and the normal asset allocation shifts into stocks, what have you, at lower prices? The clearest answer is, in terms of a structural change, an awareness of higher rates and how that recalibrates equity values.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, Dave, is that asset prices are overvalued because interest rates are artificially undervalued. And so if you're looking at prices and you're going, I'm not going to pay that price until they raise rates. What you're really doing is looking down the road and saying those prices are going to come down.
They have to. And so we've discussed this before. Rates are a basic ingredient in your discounted cash flow models. They're a basic ingredient in investment hurdle rates. And as rates rise, you can expect a reduction in returns on capital and therefore a reduction in the value of those assets. So right. An asset manager who's assuming a zero rate environment is happy to price assets to the moon. But if all of a sudden you have to recalibrate on the basis of a rising interest rate environment, what's the other part of the equation? The other part of the equation is interest rates up, asset prices down.
Right.
So this is again where your institutions who would ordinarily step in and support a falling market, if they take the Fed at their word that rates are going to rise, they're not willing to step in. Not yet. Maybe they will at some point, but there's absolutely no reason for them to do that until you've gotten rates to a normalized level. That's a long way from here.
Well, one of the dangers of that, we've seen this in a number of fields, is that if they're the buyers of last resort, they're the providers of liquidity to people who want to sell those assets today.
Well, that's exactly right. Alarion is raising the interesting point that volatility may be changing the behavior of the largest institutions as it relates to that role of buyer as last resort.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if you change the buyer of last resort and remove them from the equation? Well, that not only exaggerates volatility, but as you say, it also diminishes who you're selling product into. Where'd liquidity go?
Yeah, one of the amazing wake-up calls to any investor in anything is when they buy something thinking that they can just go ahead and sell it anytime. And when they actually come to do that, including bonds, municipal bonds, it can be stocks, when they go to do that, they find out that there's no one to buy.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Doug Nolan points that out when he describes financial assets as having quote-unquote moneyness. What does that mean exactly? Well, a financial asset that's been treated as a money-like instrument is regarded first as something that's safe. And to the degree that central banks have encouraged the inflation of prices, and if you want to borrow from the old Greenspan put days, guaranteed that there's really no downside, then you can view financial assets as quote-unquote safe.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second component is to have that moneyness quality, those financial assets are quote-unquote liquid.
You got to be able to sell it.
That's right. So liquidity is the attribute that I think is less understood. There's a few months ago, we talked about the issue of illiquidity sort of latent in the market. And it was in talking about the popularization of index funds and ETFs. My son and I had just met John Bogle in New York, who started the Vanguard Funds and sort of popularized what has now become indexing and ETFs and things of that nature. There are now trillions of dollars in these asset baskets,
right.
ETFs, or basically proxies for market segments, which hold more or less liquid assets. And the investors who own them assume that with the click of a mouse, they can buy it. With the click of a mouse, they can sell it.
You know what it reminds me of, Dave? Okay, I don't know how many times you do the buy it with one click now on Amazon. I do. In fact, it's dangerous, okay? They advertised, I bought some shaving soap on Amazon the other day, and a couple of days later, they advertised a nice new bristle brush to go with that. Well, of course, buy it with one click. Then they advertised something else that sort of ties in. It's
buy
like,
it
well,
with
of course,
one click.
Buy it with one click. The problem is you can't sell an ETF with one click if there's no buyers.
Well, the point I want to make is that not all the constituent parts are created equal, though they will be sold in equal measure in the event of a mass liquidation. 2016, in my opinion, is likely to be the time frame where these kinds of products face their first real structural difficulties.
Mm.
What if no market maker is interested in taking the assets in?
Right.
What if there's no real bid that seems reasonable? Liquidity is the issue. And I think you're dealing with an environment where we may see radical price drops because the vehicles which have assumed liquidity that no longer provide it, but again, by contract, by legal force, have to liquidate the assets
mm-hmm.
when requested, force this catastrophic decline in prices. And so what happens? We haven't been there yet, except in the quote-unquote flash crashes of 2012, 13, 14, and 15. The instances where we've seen flash crashes, they basically unwind the trades and reset the clock.
Right.
And I'm not sure how we navigate the next couple of years if those shifts in value are radical enough and the exchanges have to step in and call a do-over. It's to some degree like Ben Bernanke, you know, he commented in this week's Wall Street Journal. The Fed can mitigate recessions, he says, just point blank. We can mitigate recessions. And we can determine inflation. We can determine employment rates. He takes credit for that. So why can't exchanges mitigate declines and determine the trajectories for stocks? Why can't they just always make them go higher? And when they go lower, in the extreme, just say, we're not going to count that.
Well, they can to a degree if they're continually given free money by the Fed. But let's face it, reality still has to set in at some point.
In both cases, what you're talking about is artificially fixing reality.
Right.
And hoping that it sticks. And in both cases, a casual observer might say that you've basically eliminated the market. If you can, by decree, make something so, this is what the price of the interest rate is going to be, therefore, this is what the price of the bond will be. This is what the price of the stock will be, and we will erase that nasty little downturn. Capital doesn't know what to do with that. So, you know, we started by saying there's this growing conflict between labor and capital, and the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, underscores moving into an era where labor is probably going to be favored over capital. And then we also have the artificial nature of the markets where people who are allocating capital, when they see how artificial the inputs are into the market, do you know what they say? I don't like it. I don't trust it. I don't understand it. It doesn't make sense. It's not rational. I think I'll just take my marbles and go home. And this complements Napier's thoughts, which we mentioned last week, that capital may very well disappear for a while. And what was the last period of time where that happened? 1944 to 1949, where the footprint of the government was so large that private capital basically said, we don't know how to make money with our money. We're either going to get taxed out of existence or the reward for the risk taken is going to be snatched from us. Why would we play this game?
Mm-hmm.
It's not within our arms to control. So why don't we just disappear for a while?
This week was the first week ever that U.S. Treasuries, 3-month Treasuries, sold for 0%. That shows there's demand for 3-month Treasuries. That shows there's demand for cash. The gold, we talked about this last week and the week before, the gold is running out. The supplies of gold are running out. Anyone who's trying to buy physical gold is paying a premium right now because there's not much out there. We're seeing the same thing with Treasuries. Now, you still have a lot of people sitting in stocks and bonds thinking that they can sell them at any time. Now, Dave, you told a story just a few minutes ago before we started recording of a friend of yours and your dad's who was in the bond market in the brokerage business back in the 1970s. And he walked into his boss's office and he saw stacks of paper behind him. And he said, what's that? And I'd like you to tell the rest of the story.
Well, it was all the bonds that that firm could not sell. And these were client assets that had been returned. Again, this was a day in which paper reigned.
Right.
And there was no sort of digital accounting for who owned what. You had stock certificates, you had bond certificates. And in this case, he had stacks of bonds, which there was no market for. No one wanted to buy them.
Right.
No one wanted them.
So like consignment, like taking something down and selling something on consignment, like somebody selling a guitar at a pawn shop.
If somebody comes in the door and wants it,
yeah,
and is willing to pay the offered price or wants to make an offer on it, maybe we'll consider that offer. But right now, there is no market for it. Well, liquidity issues are going to look different now than they did when the bonds were stacking up behind this Wall Street guy in his office. What I think is much more likely is you click the mouse to sell the asset and the bid drops to the floor. You thought you were going to get X price for the ETF that you own, and lo and behold, it's 20 to 30% less when the trade settles.
Mm-hmm.
That's an indication of illiquidity. Why? Well, everything's liquid at a certain price.
Last week, you recommended that a person hedge their portfolio, which means if you own stock, you take the opposite bet in the form of a put option or selling short that same stock. Now, isn't a hedged portfolio also to some degree at risk if there's no liquidity in the market?
Let's look at this in the big picture. We've talked about hedging an equity portfolio, and we've encouraged clients to get to a neutral position.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to raising cash, having a precious metals allocation, there's a flaw in thinking that a hedged portfolio is one that has eliminated risk.
Mm-hmm.
It may have eliminated a degree of risk for you, but no risk is ever eliminated by hedging. It's simply shifted to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Whenever you create a hedge, you're making a bet that neutralizes another bet, a directional bet. You think this is going to go up and you buy the other side of the equation. You think it's going to go down and it just creates sort of a neutral balance, if you will. Imagine the scale with an equal amount of weight on each side, right? Now it's in balance. Now it's equal and level. to do that, someone in the options or futures market, in the derivative market, is willing to, quote-unquote, take the other side of the trade.
They're betting against you, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. So one of you is going to make money and one of you is going to lose money. But somebody must lose. So risk may have been offloaded, but it was not eliminated. And in fact, if you recall the 1987 crash, it's what exaggerated the decline. You had more and more people getting themselves insurance on existing stock positions. And the more insurance they bought to cover their existing portfolio insurance, quote unquote, the lower the shares they were insuring.
They were betting against themselves in a way.
They were betting against themselves to cover their existing position. And the more they bet against themselves, the more the price declined. The biggest permutation today is that there are insurance products that don't openly trade.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the derivative contracts which, you know, take reams of paper and specialized lawyers to read. And one of those contracts, if it's in violation, may trigger a legal obligation to pay. But when do you pay and how do you enforce it? Because it's a legal contract, it's going to take a date in court to make sure that a judge says, well, you must pay now.
It reminds me of Argentine bonds. Okay. Talk about fighting something. Argentina could have either just declared bankruptcy or it's been in court for years.
Well, that's exactly right. You've got a number of hedge funds that want repayment on debt and there's been a default which has occurred, but who's going to enforce it? And on a contract basis, it's going to take someone to intermediate. The old school hedging had sort of an automatic recalibration to it. And the new school hedging using derivative contracts, it may or may not even be enforceable, certainly not on an automatic basis. So the conclusion in all of this is that rather than merely hedging a portfolio from volatility, speculators have taken the hedging idea to a new level. They've believed that risk has been quote unquote eliminated, and therefore more risk can be layered into a portfolio allocation mix to enhance their returns.
Mm-hmm.
What's the net result? Well, there's more risk in the marketplace, there's more systemic pressure, and there's lots of people believing that they are adequately hedged because the counterparties have them covered.
They're sleeping safe at night when really the Titanic may be sinking underneath them.
Yep. And one thing the world is very limited on, and this is in spite of ample central bank liquidity that's been created, there are no vast sums of idle cash laying around amongst the financial community to serve as payment if a counterparty is required to make good on those derivative contracts.
Right.
And you know, this is where, again, you begin to see cracks in the system. Someone like we mentioned last week, a commodity trading firm who begins to go under, who's on the other side of all their bets? Are they going to be okay? Is this going to represent financial solvency, insolvency? Are we going to end up with something like an MF Global all over again as we watch this large commodity trading firm in Switzerland implode?
It's like a pyramid scheme, Dave. You know, when you look at a pyramid scheme, or let's just even say a multi-level marketing program that doesn't really have a product, as long as you have five new friends that you can bring in, and they have five new friends and five more new friends, the whole thing continues to work. But when you start running out of the five new friends, the whole thing falls apart.
It's the actual cash available, which is the missing element. So what makes the derivative pyramid scheme so dangerous is the lack of actual cash available relative to the commitments outstanding. And you go back to the 2006, 2008 memory bank, if you will, and you had a liquidity crisis. I mean, you're talking about firms that are very significant. I mean, AIG was not an insignificant firm. One of the largest insurance companies in the world, you'd say, well, they've got to have billions in cash.
Well, they were solvent.
If they had billions in cash, they needed tens of billions. If they had tens of billions in cash, they needed hundreds of billions. The point was there was a mismatch in terms of the liabilities and their ability to make good on them in short order.
But on paper, they were solvent.
That's right. So you ended up with a liquidity crisis triggering a solvency crisis on the street. So that kind of liquidity is still lacking. And as volatility increases, more and more participants have and will continue to seek quote-unquote protections in the derivatives market. Well, listen, at this point, God forbid something bad actually occur in the derivative space, because the same liquidity solvency dynamics exist today as they did in 08 and 09. They still exist. And to some degree, they've been exaggerated. I think this is where you see the special place that gold and silver play in a portfolio. One of the few spaces that you can put money that allows you to have a financial asset without counterparty risk. It's underappreciated today, that element of non-counterparty exposure. But it was a core emphasis in 2008 and 2009 amongst large and sophisticated investors coming into the gold space in particular.
Right.
And I think that's going to be a core emphasis at some point in the future, and a prime reason why in the months and years ahead that people will demand physical delivery at any price.
You know, there's a lot of false pride and hubris built into the system. You know, you look at Bernanke coming out with his new book, and he's just so incredibly proud of the job that he's done.
Yeah, I think the History Channel could likely do a special on him like they do on World War One, World War Two veterans, and really just sort of, you know, you can hear the music playing, you feel the triumphalism, you feel the patriotic zeal, and then you have a recap, and this is what Bernanke actually basically did in this week's Wall Street Journal. I am writing this reflection on the success of a successful man while at the helm of a most successful central bank, which succeeded in saving the world and, oh, the economy, too. I mean, it was pretty funny. And we did our job, but what about everyone else? We really were the ones who stood in the gap. I mean, again, roll music, maybe bombs bursting in air, the rockets' red glare, and there was Ben Bernanke who saved the world.
Well, and we talked about Greek tragedy. Greek tragedy, the entertainment value of Greek tragedy is that hubris gets reduced in humility.
Richard Fisher commented this last week. You may recall he retired from the Dallas Fed at the end of last year. And he underscored something that we mentioned in the commentary a week ago, that monetary policy has done what it can do.
Right. They've spent their bullets.
They have. They're out of ammunition. You can go to QE4. The question is, how long will it give you any benefit before people realize that it's a desperate measure stacked on top of three previous desperate measures, none of which worked, or delivered what they were advertised in terms of what they were supposed to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps that's why Mr. Fisher left the Fed last year. I think it's perhaps, and again, this is conjecture on my part, but when you hear the music and anticipate it stopping, choose your seat, go ahead and maybe even start moving in that direction and take the seat before the music stops.
So do you think Yellen is still walking around as the music is starting to stop?
Well, he said that not only had Yellen backed herself into a corner, but that monetary policy had played out. You recall what Napier has suggested, the next round of reflation. The next round of reflation is likely to come from fiscal stimulus because monetary policy measures have already been acknowledged as dangerous if allowed to linger, and they have also been seen as ineffectual in creating economic activity. So we've been talking about an exit strategy from our monetary policy since 2011. They haven't done anything.
Right.
And, you know, now we have last week the Atlanta Fed posting its updated real-time models of the U.S. GDP. And instead of their previous estimates of growth at 1.8%, that's what they had estimated as of September 28th, the calendar rolls over to October 1st, and they reduce that to 0.9. So they cut it in half. And, you know, that's on top of last week's September employment report. And come on, 201,000 was the expected number. We ended up with 142,000, along with the revisions downward for August and July. You've got the revisions, which I think are very significant when you consider that the positive expectations built into the stock market in those months, both July and August, turn out to be premature.
Mm-hmm.
They turn out to be premature. In fairness, we always talk about the death-birth models, and these are your fabricated numbers, whether it's people who've died and they're taking them out or arbitrarily putting them in, just assuming that this number of people have been born, therefore there should be this number of jobs created. Whether or not those jobs are actually created doesn't matter. Statistically, it's just a way of imputing, on average, the number of people who are coming in and out of our culture.
It's a little like massaging Kobe beef. You know, it's that same type of thing. You're just trying to make it taste just a little bit better to the public.
Well, in this case, it was a negative 34,000. So in fairness, we always acknowledge when they've goosed the number.
Right.
This instance, they took out 34,000 jobs. Factor those back in and you still have a disappointing number. Your 201,000 number still comes in shy of that. If you factor in your birth death models, 34 plus your 142, you're still well below the estimate. It was interesting, the participation rate put in a new low. That is 62.2%, a 38-year low. And even Bernanke took the time to comment on that in his Wall Street Journal article. You know, after saying basically, we can determine the unemployment rate. He says, but there is this anomaly, the participation rate, which still isn't quite in line. So maybe our labor problems aren't completely whipped yet.
Well, and let's go ahead and call it what it is. Participation rate of 62% is saying that 6 out of 10 people in the United States actually have a job.
Right. So of the people that could be employed, that's also saying that basically over 90 million don't.
Right.
So this 5.1% number is a number that we should all cheer. But there is this anomaly that goes unexplained.
Which sounds more like 38% to me.
How are we dealing with it with a participation rate? People that could work and aren't working, that equals over 90 million people.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
That's a big deal.
Well, like you said, you know, Bernanke may be a hero. You know, we're in an age right now where the superhero movie seems to be bringing in most of the box office money. So maybe now we'll start to see Marvel pick up Ben Bernanke and give him some sort of superpower.
I can see it. He's on the cover of his book. He's wearing a cape. He is not only the man of the hour, but he is some salvific character to him. It's fantastic.
Well, Dave, before we wrap up here, I know liquidity is a big issue on this particular program. What we're talking about is if you can't sell something, you really are stuck with it until you can. And that can change the price. But there's another issue with what you've done and what your family's done all of your life. And that is in the gold business, it's not about liquidity as much as it is supply. That's the other side of things. And as you brought up last week, supply is literally drying up.
There's something very interesting here because, I mean, we source product from all over the world. And occasionally we'll find a large hoard of product, and that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But it's once in a blue moon that that occurs. And ordinarily, we're dealing with product that's in the secondary market in floats between people who want to sell and people who want to buy. And there's just kind of a general stock out there. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty thin float of product. What we see right now is that all smaller products are already diminishing. There's still some out there, but it's diminishing rapidly.
Now, when you say small, you're talking about the smaller than 1 ounce coins, something half ounce, quarter ounce, that type of thing. And silver.
Correct. And definitely, so I would say the man on the street, when he's making a purchase, he's interested in small products.
Right.
He's not buying a 400 ounce gold bar. He's not buying a 1,000 ounce silver bar. Those are products that are more in tune and in keeping with an institutional purchase, mm-hmm. or a large investor purchase that's going to be stored someplace else.
But a quarter ounce gold coin or a 1 ounce silver coin, those are barterable.
That's right. What I find intriguing is something that has changed in recent years. U.S. fabricators are gone.
Mm.
Inglehart is gone. Johnson Matthey is gone. They got bought by the Japanese beer company, Asahi, and they don't provide product for the U.S. anymore. So when you're dealing with this issue of small product, and when it runs out, there's an interesting thing that occurs, because you can look and say, well, but there's tons of 400-ounce good delivery bars. The problem is nobody wants a 400-ounce good delivery gold bar. Most people are not buying gold in increments of $500,000 or more.
Right.
Right? You might buy $1,000, $10,000, $100,000, but this is the issue. There are plenty of 1,000-ounce silver bars. I mean, I can get my hands on 26 million ounces of silver tomorrow in 1,000-ounce bar format. But if I wanted that in 1-ounce coins or 10-ounce bars or 100-ounce bars, not doable.
Even with delayed delivery, it's not possible.
Well, it just depends on how delayed.
Right.
But the reality is the fabrication business has completely changed. And some of the main players that were there 20 and 30 years ago, they don't even exist today. Mm. So in an environment of increased demand, you're dealing with a stratification in the marketplace where the common man who buys anything less than a kilo gold bar is not going to have access. And your institution will have access, but only on the large format products. Mm-hmm. And you say to yourself, well, why can't you take those bars and just melt them down and turn them into something that's smaller and good for regular distribution?
Well, and don't they do that?
The fabricators are out of business.
Right.
They went the way of the dodo bird in the last bear market. And your primary producer, which was JM here in the United States, Johnson Matthey, they don't have a retail arm. They don't have product provisions. They've made the determination that dealing with industrial uses for metals is far more a reliable demand source than investors, which can be very fickle. And they've basically shifted all of their fabricating capacity towards industrial users. So you're in this interesting space. And I think the next few years are going to create some fascinating dynamics where premiums on particular products exist and no premiums exist on other products. And so how you position in a portfolio, I think, will be very interesting. There'll be some great opportunities in light of that and an ability to arbitrage between products and capture those premiums in terms of new and greater ounce positions for a client. But again, these are some things that we're seeing both in the US market and in the overseas market.
So Dave, it's my turn to be a broken record. You're still saying gold and cash and gold. And as we saw a few days ago, cash at this point is paying 0% if you're buying 3-month treasuries, and gold is becoming very, very scarce.
I just think that the next 12 to 18 months, you're going to see the little guy priced out of the gold market and priced out of the silver market. Unless you're able to step up to a 1,000-ounce silver bar or a greater than kilo bar size in the gold space, being priced out of the market is the reality on the horizon.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.